the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and the World Trade Organization, which it joined in 2007. The internationalist communist world in which Ho Chi Minh and his party had circulated for so long was no more. Non-communist Asia in particular ensured the success of modern Vietnam's renovation at the turn of the 21st century. As of 1989, the Soviet Union had accounted for 34% of the SRV's exports and 63% of its imports. With the disappearance of the communist world by 1991, those same numbers had dropped to 10% and 13% respectively. Filling the gap were Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and, increasingly, China, not the French or the Americans. Asian countries provided 82% of communist Vietnam's imports in 1992 and absorbed 60% of its exports a year later. The advanced economic development and vitality of Asian capitalism and trade in the late 20th century helped Vietnam modernize in ways colonialism and communism had always blocked. But, as in China, this internal and external revolution in communist Vietnam raises important questions. For one, the SRV's embrace of capitalist-oriented development means that the communist vision of the world announced by Truong Chinh in 1950, casting Vietnam as the Indochinese frontline communist soldier fighting the capitalist imperialists in Southeast Asia, was a failure. 3.5 decades later, the leader of the Vietnamese Communist Party, Truong Chinh, whose name means the Long March, made the astonishing statement that the party had to adopt the Doi Moi reforms because the party had erred in our desire to achieve transformation at an early date by quickly abolishing non-socialist economic components. This came from the very men who had pushed through radical Maoist reforms in 1950s and had embraced orthodox communism all his life. At the head of the party again, he now embraced capitalist-minded reforms like his counterparts in China. The survival of his Vietnam depended on it. Secondly, while the communist leadership has celebrated the Socialist Republic of Vietnam's historic entry into the ASEAN and its normalization of relations with the United States in 1995 as diplomatic victories, viewed over a long span of time, the opposite is arguably the case. By joining forces with the Americans and the ASEAN countries, the Vietnamese Communist Corps had in many ways admitted its failure to build a modern Vietnam and to promote an alternative communist-oriented Southeast Asia, as was first pioneered by Ho Chi Minh, himself one of the creators of the Thai and Malayan Communist Parties back in 1930. If the Vietnamese communists scored an historic victory in 1975 over the Americans and unified the country for the first time in over a century, in 1995, the United States and the ASEAN also won when lifelong communists embraced the global capitalist system against which they had fought for most of their lives. Leaders in Hanoi, Washington, and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Capital Cities may all share a fear of Chinese expansion into the South China Sea today, but the reason why they can collaborate today is because the SRV abandoned communism during the Third Indochina War and withdrew from Cambodia. And, just as important, the Eurasian Communist Bloc, of which the Vietnamese communists were once proud and willing members, simply no longer exists. Chapter 14. Vietnam from Beyond the Red River. We must know how to use our military units correctly, so as to send them in large numbers to open land and create new economic zones. These units must consist of many soldiers and fighters who are unshakable and enthusiastic in their revolutionary spirit and desire to succeed, so as to move mountains and dig rivers that will transform these empty regions and deserts into land covered with fertile fields supporting a thriving population. Prime Minister Pham Van Dong, 1977. The empty lands to which Pham Van Dong referred in this 1977 address were the highlands of modern Vietnam. Rising from the Gulf of Tonkin in the northeast, this collection of cragged hills and deep valleys stretches westward, looping around the Red River lowlands as it drops southward down the central coastline before finally vanishing into the Mekong Delta. This massif makes up almost half of Vietnam territorially today. It teems with rivers, forests, animals, and some of Vietnam's most important natural resources, zinc, ore, bauxite, and silver, and plantation crops, rubber, coffee, and tea. It also offers protection. During the First Indochina War, the Northern Highlands were home to the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and the site of its historic battle victory over the French in 1954. A few years later, the DRV pushed its supply lines further southward through the Central Highlands to feed and arm forces fighting the Americans. Without the Highlands, there would have been no victory at Dien Bien Phu and no operational Ho Chi Minh Trail. Speaking in 1977, as Vietnamese communists prepared to go to war again over Indochina, Pham Van Dong had good reason to dispatch soldiers into these areas. He erred, however, when he spoke of the Highlands as empty places. They were not, and the Prime Minister knew it. He had served there during the 1940s. By now, the astute listener will have noticed that the narrative to this point has been a very lowland and Viet-centric one. This history of modern Vietnam began in the Red River Delta at the dawn of the first millennium CE to follow a range of lowland Viet kings, settlers, administrators, revolutionaries, missionaries, state builders, and workers as they made their way south. After the city of Hanoi came that of Hue, followed by Saigon. While the simplicity of the north-to-south take renders it almost irresistible for those trying to order a narrative for Vietnam's unwieldy past, this standard view comes with serious problems. For one, it is a linear teleological approach, organized around the inexorable expansion of the Viet people from one delta to another. Scholars inside and outside Vietnam refer to it widely as the Nam Thien, southward advance, school of thought. Secondly, this north-south narrative is very ethnocentric. It downplays the importance of the non-Viet peoples who lived in lowland areas of the central coastline and the Mekong Delta, most notably the Cham, the Khmer, and the Chinese. It does the same for the highlands, where dozens of non-Viet peoples like the Thai and Yarai constituted the majority populations until the late 20th century. As we have heard in this book, until recently, there was no one S-like Vietnam running from north to south. And this brings us back to the tricky question of Vietnamese colonialism. Advocates of the Southern Advance School tend to celebrate ethnic Viet expansion southward as a sign of strength and vitality. Heroism serves as the favorite trope. Like their Euro-American counterparts, Viet settlers were determined, hardy souls who, through their blood, sweat, and tears, turned all of these blank spaces into productive fields, brought civilization and modernity to its primitive peoples, and ensured that Vietnam would persevere over its rivals. Missing in this frontier myth is any discussion of how the Viet often took these lands from others, how they conquered people by force, or how the Viet colonizers and the non-Viet colonized also interacted in much more complex ways. Communist historians in Vietnam today still try to avoid this question altogether, knowing that they created a powerful nationalist myth during the Indochina Wars by casting the Viet as the heroic colonized people who threw off the yoke of Western imperialism. Like their Chinese counterparts, Vietnamese communists find it terribly hard to admit that they, too, have been colonizers. Each prefers to extend the idea of a unitary Vietnam far back into the past. Many foreign historians supportive of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's heroic struggle against the French, the Americans, and the Chinese have also conveniently avoided this chapter in modern Vietnam's history. This will no longer do. just as no serious student of American history would accept uncritically Frederick Jackson Turner's famous frontier thesis, which cast American history as the unique product of the inexorable expansion of settlers westward, so too should we avoid the southward advance version organizing the history of modern Vietnam into one single march from southern China to the Gulf of Thailand. Nor should we avoid Vietnam's own colonial history because it places the Viet in the role of conqueror instead of the victim of foreign domination. This also means accepting that the Cham, Khmer, Jarai, Radi, Banar, Thai, Hmong, and others are central, not marginal, to our story. For centuries, they ruled other Vietnams and resisted the making of a colonial Vietnam. So before ending this book, let us return to the past again. But this time, let us reset our narrative and chronology by beginning in areas beyond the Red River Delta, in the rich world of the highlands, along the central coast, and in the Mekong Delta, before the Viet arrived. And then let us consider how the non-Viet people resisted and interacted with Viet state-making, including its imperial forms. It is time to let go of Viet exceptionalism and ethnocentrism as much as its French, Chinese, or American variants. Before the Viet came, the coastal and highland peoples of Vietnam, where mainland Southeast Asia and the Indian Ocean meet. Some 10,000 years ago, two groups of people, each with unique linguistic patterns, colonized wide swaths of mainland Southeast Asia, the Austronesians and the Austroasiatics. The Austronesians originated from the island of Taiwan between 5 and 7,000 years ago. While these peoples had brought agricultural techniques with them from southern China, they also developed sophisticated navigational skills and techniques which allowed them to cross the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean from around the 3rd millennium BCE onward. Their movements were such that by the 1st millennium BCE, many had reached the coasts of Japan, Vietnam, the Philippines, Java, Sumatra, Polynesia, and Hawaii. Others ventured westward into the Indian Ocean. Some got as far as Madagascar off the eastern African coast, making the Austronesians the first people to cross the Indian Ocean, long before the Chinese, Middle Easterners, and Europeans. Over the centuries, these people settled down across large swathes of island and mainland Southeast Asia and contributed to building smaller political units, cultures, and languages. Located at the center of these maritime movements was today's central Vietnam, where Austronesians made landfall sometime before the 1st millennium CE. Many of them moved into the nearby highlands in search of game, people who eventually became the Jarai, Radi, and Raglai. Others, such as the Cham, remained mainly on the coastline, learning to plant rice, fish, and trade. Connections between the high and lowlands continued over time, as did exchanges with the Indian Ocean world. Indeed, it is useful to think of coastal Vietnam as an extension of archipelago Southeast Asia. To the north, the Austroasiatic family moved overland from today's India to mainland Southeast Asia by way of southern China. This linguistic group emerged in the Neolithic period around 4,000 years ago. The Austroasiatic peoples were agriculturally oriented. They planted rice and taro as they followed fish-laden streams and rivers from one valley to another. Some of the earliest settled agricultural communities emerged around 2000 BCE, inside the deltas of the Red, Mekong, and Chao Phraya rivers, which dropped down from southern China. These peoples may have initially originated in the Mekong River's lower branches around 4,000 years ago. They then followed inland waterways westward and northward into the Chao Phraya, Thailand, and Red River, Vietnam, deltas, foraging, fishing, and planting their way along. The Austroasiatics included the Khmer, Banar, Sedang, Hre, and others. Even the future Viet rulers of the Red River Delta heralded from this wider world. In fact, Linguists place the Viet language in the Proto-Mon Khmer subcategory of the Austroasiatic linguistic family. Sinization came later with the extension of the Han Empire into the Red River area. The arrival of the Austronesians along the coastline tended to keep the Austroasiatics within inland areas. However, the two linguistic families often mixed as Austronesians migrated into upland areas, especially in the central highlands of Vietnam. This rapid journey into the depths of time allows us to appreciate the extent to which these peoples had spread throughout upland and lowland parts of Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, and southern China, and had begun developing their own civilizations and polities. The appearance of a distinctive Austroasiatic style of pottery during the first millennium BCE is a case in point. The production of Dong Sun drums is yet another. Although these drums seem to have originated from the Red River Valley, attesting to the cultural vitality of this region, they were products of a common cultural core extending into today's Thailand and the southern Chinese massif discussed in Chapter 1. Further to the south, the peoples of Austronesian stock presided over the creation of flourishing commercial centers and civilizations anchored along the coast, which ran from central Vietnam to the Gulf of Thailand. During the first millennium CE, the spread of the Iron Age and advances in agricultural techniques allowed new coastal polities such as Akyo, Funan, and Sahoin to emerge. The ability of these coastal polities to tap into Indian Ocean commercial exchanges extending from the Middle East to the Han Empire reinforced their state-building, economic development, and cultural expansion. The demand in the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and China for Southeast Asian spices and luxury goods was particularly important. As early as the 3rd century BCE, Chinese analysts wrote of cloves growing in island Southeast Asia, where their Roman counterparts made similar reports some centuries later. Given the vibrancy of the Indian Ocean trade, we should not be surprised that archaeologists have unearthed Roman coins in the coastal polity of Akyo in today's southern Vietnam. Thanks to these early maritime connections, local leaders in central and southern Vietnam not only traded with the Eurasian world, but they also adopted foreign religions and writing systems coming from abroad, adapted them to local spiritual, cultural, and political contexts, and, in doing so, often turned them into something unique. Over the centuries, peoples and leaders in Akyo, Funan, and Hasoin adopted Hinduism, Mahayana, and then Theravada Buddhism. Sanskrit and Indian Brahmanic-based scripts and inscriptions appeared for the first time as local leaders and clergy developed writing systems to express their spoken languages, ideas, and sacred beliefs. Indian concepts of kingship, astronomy, calendric time, music, and philosophy found clients in these early non-Viet civilizations. And this Indianization occurred over centuries, succeeded in some areas, failed in others, but was always tailored to local needs. This was certainly true of the powerful Khmer leaders who emerged by the end of the first millennium CE. In 802, King Jayavarman II laid the foundations of a mighty Khmer Empire based near Tonle Sap, with the Mekong River feeding it in the rainy season. Thanks to this abundant water supply, Khmer rulers developed an elaborate hydraulic complex, an Angkor Wat, capable of irrigating rice plants and thus producing ever larger amounts of it. This, in turn, supported one of the largest pre-modern urban populations in the world. Khmer rulers also drew their strength from maritime commerce and used combined persuasion and brute force to expand their empire northward into Laos and eastward into the Mekong Delta. Although the Mekong Delta, the Vietnamese coastline, and the surrounding highlands were not heavily populated, these were obviously not empty spaces. Nor were they isolated from the wider region and the world. The central Vietnamese coast in particular offered great opportunities to its inhabitants, but it also posed potential threats. After all, if the Han extended their empire into the Red River Delta, making it their southernmost province, it was in part because they wanted an opening to the Indian Ocean trade. For 1,000 years, the Han Empire ruled the Red River Valley. The Lin Yi and the Cham coastal states of the Indian Ocean. To the south of China's Jiaozi province emerged new non-Viet states, each of which benefited from its maritime connections to India, China, and the highlands. Over the course of the first millennium, new polities succeeded those of Funan, Hasoin, and Akio. By the 4th and 5th centuries, a new confederation of coastal kingdoms, collectively known as Lin Yi, emerged south of the Red River Delta. Initially based around Wei, this polity's leaders took full advantage of their maritime position by trading vigorously with the Indian Ocean world. They expanded their trading to include intensive exchanges with their Chinese neighbor, whose growing economic and cultural development offered new opportunities. While Lin Yi rulers continued to adapt Indian religions and ideas, they also imported Chinese pottery, architectural styles, art, and ideas through China's Jiaozi province. The line between East Asia and China and Southeast Asia and India was never a sharp one in practice. Cham polities emerged in the Tuban Valley, Na Trang, and Phan Rang. Like the Austronesians before them, the Cham arrived in Vietnam via the sea, possibly from the Philippines. They traded actively with China, India, and the Middle East. They too tailored Hinduism and Buddhism to local needs and used Sanskrit to create a writing system for the Cham language, perhaps the first for Southeast Asia. The Lin Yi and Cham coastal federations coexisted until around the 6th century, when, for reasons that are not clear, the two states melded into one, which was increasingly referred to as Champa. Until the 11th century and even later, Champa ruled the coast of central Vietnam, from the southern border of China's Jiaozi province to the Khmer Empire and the Mekong Delta. Again, there was no Vietnam during the first millennium. Nor was there ever one unified Cham state or empire. Champa was, in reality, an archipelago-like constellation of small interconnected coastal kingdoms scattered down the central coastline. Over the centuries, these polities divided into 5 major realms. 1. Indrapura, located in today's provinces of Quang Binh, Quang Tri, and Tua Tien. 2. Amavarati, in Quang Nam, Quang Nai province, and on the Tuban River. 3. Vijaya, Binh Dinh and along the Khan River. 4. Panduranga, in Ninh Thuan, Binh Thuan, and along the Dinh River. And 5. Kautara, Phu Yen, Khan Hoa, and along the Kai River. They were decentralized kingdoms whose populations gravitated around a charismatic monarch in a specific location. Each kingdom possessed its own religious markers and separate commercial and agricultural activities. Borders were fluid and often overlapped. Power was diffuse. Champa, like other neighboring polities at the time, was a collection of small territories, a patchwork of often overlapping mandalas, or circles of kings. Stronger polities could absorb smaller ones, often doing so violently. This federation of small polities had much in common with the coastal states of archipelago Southeast Asia today, such as Majapahit in today's Indonesia, then the imperially structured Chinese state to the north, or the more centralized mainland ones that would later emerge in the Red River, Dai Viet, Chao Phraya, Thailand, and Irrawaddy, Burma, deltas. In fact, the Cham dispatched official delegations to Majapahit, married their children into island royal families, and served as the intermediaries for commercial, cultural, and religious transfers across archipelago Southeast Asia. Malay peoples were also present in Cham courts, ports, and armies. The Cham also interacted with the nearby Austronesian and Austroasiatic peoples living in the highlands, the Radi, Roglai, Yorai, Banar, Hri, and others. The latter provided Cham traders with much sought-after luxury goods for the Indian Ocean and Chinese markets, such as rhinoceros horns, ivory, cinnamon, and especially aromatic woods. Eagle wood was particularly important. Cham artistic exchanges, sculptures, statues, and stelae, spread inward by overland routes and deep into the Indian Ocean islands by sea. At different times, some Cham kings used these connections to extend their political influence far into the Massif. Champasak, the name of a central Laotian province today, is suggestive of such ties. Some Highlanders even became Cham kings, and thanks to their commercial networks, Cham merchants served as the intermediaries for the export of Red River ceramics into Indian Ocean markets. Cham coastal links eventually brought them into contact with another religion coming from the far western border of the Indian Ocean, Islam. Arab traders had long traded with Southeast Asia in spices and aromatic woods. From the 13th and 14th centuries onward, these traders and the missionaries traveling with them, Sufis, began to spread the Islamic religion rapidly through the coastal polities of island Southeast Asia. Sultanates emerged in such places as Majapahit. Linked commercially, culturally, and matrimonially to archipelago courts, the Cham brought Islam to the Vietnamese coast in the 15th century. In so doing, they joined the Khmer and their Austronesian predecessors in transforming areas below the Red River into a fascinating religious mosaic combining Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and pre-existing Austronesian animistic beliefs and practices. Meanwhile, in Jiaozi province, the Chinese introduced characters, Confucianism, Mahayana Buddhism, and new cultural practices. The Rise and Fall of Po Binasor's Champa. But even the emergence of an independent Dai Viet polity in the 11th century did not spell the end of the Cham states, the Khmer Empire, or the highlands, nor did it necessarily send the Viet pouring southward to build Vietnam in one fell swoop, as the Nam Thien myth claims. Despite the impressive efforts of Dai Viet analysts to locate a shared past in the pre-colonial period, court politics in the newly born Vietnamese state remained highly unstable as local leaders competed with each other for power and control of military and economic resources. Moreover, the threat of a Chinese return to the region was always real, and the Cham and the Khmer were no regional pushovers. 20th century Cham and Khmer nationalists would like us to believe that they were the Pacific victims of Vietnamese colonial aggression, but some centuries earlier their leaders had fought each other and neither had any qualms about attacking the nascent Dai Viet state in the north to expand their own empires. Attracted in large part by Champa's growing trade with Song China, 960 to 1279, discussed in Chapter 1, in the late 12th century the Khmers attacked and occupied Cham territories, setting up their headquarters in the area of Ajaya in Binh Dinh province today. The Cham pushed back and, in 1226, drove out the Khmers in order to create their own power base in Ajaya. The new leaders also took full advantage of the greater Chinese interaction in the Indian Ocean trade to strengthen their own state and finance a large standing army. Following the defeat of the Mongols in China in 1368, the Cham again improved trading and diplomatic relations with China's new leaders, the commercially and expansionist-minded Ming. It was in this wider context that a remarkably charismatic Cham king named Po Binasor, Che Bong Na in Vietnamese, took power and presided over a golden age in Cham history in the late 14th century. Not only did Po unite the various Cham polities under his control, but he also sought to regain lands the Cham had ceded or lost to the Dai Viet. In 1371, with a green light from China, Po drove his armies overland into the Red River Delta, landed his warships on the coast, and marched his men on the Dai Viet capital of Hanoi. Cham troops looted Hanoi and burnt the enemy's palace to the ground as civilians ran for cover. In 1376, Po Binasor struck again, overpowering the Dai Viet forces and this time even killing the country's king. By the late 14th century, the Cham had not only recovered their lands, but they had also pushed their polity into the lower Red River Basin and fostered better relations with China in doing so. If the Dai Viet had repelled the Mongol invaders, they nonetheless failed to stop the Cham from sacking their capital twice. Although Po Binisor's violent northern advance shook the young Dai Viet state to its core, the Viet held on and clawed their way back. When the Cham monarch went on the warpath again in 1390, Dai Viet forces counterattacked, killed Po Binisor in battle, and prepared to press further southward. The only forces stopping them were those of the Chinese, whose commercial interests in the Indian Ocean and its trade remained as real as ever. Admiral Zheng He's famous armadas, taking him to Africa and to the holy city of Mecca, started at this time. In 1406, Ming armies occupied the Red River and transformed it once again into an imperial province, while Zheng He's boats stopped over in Champa. Although the Dai Viet drove the Chinese out once more in 1428 and established the Lei dynasty, the country's new leaders, many of them military men coming from areas along the kingdom's southern frontier, the Lei, Trinh, and Nguyen, were convinced that the survival of their small state depended on its territorial expansion southward down into the coastal lowlands and the opening of new ground for wet rice production and relief from overpopulation in the Red River Delta. Leaders coming from southern Dai Viet also knew that Vijaya, Queenan today, provided the best opening to the lucrative trade of the Indian Ocean world. No one at the time knew where any of this would go, but it was the start of the Dai Viet colonial project that began with the massive Lei attack on Champa in 1471. The peoples of the northern highlands. While Dai Viet expansion focused mainly on the southern coastal lowlands, war, trade, and migration continued to connect the young Red River state to the surrounding massif in the north and its peoples. Over the centuries, new groups of people continued to arrive in the northern highlands from southern China, most notably the peoples of the Tai Kadai language family. Slash-and-burn agriculture predominated among them, but wet rice methods were common where valley water was available. Caravan routes crossed the massif, bringing Chinese traders, explorers, missionaries, and eventually imperial armies. Ideas, technologies, and news moved as new opportunities arose for those who would seize them. Indeed, the Viet were not the only peoples who tried to create their own state when the Tang dynasty collapsed in the 10th century. In the 11th century, the Thai-speaking Nung people, living along both sides of a loosely controlled Sino-Dai-Viet frontier, found a charismatic leader in the person of Nung Tri Khao. This young man was familiar with Han statecraft, characters, and attracted by the idea of building an independent state. In 1042, he established the Nung Kingdom of Great Succession in the areas of today's Cao Bang and Lang Song provinces. Wary of the emergence of a competing kingdom on their northern border, Dai Viet authorities carried him off to Hanoi. Upon his release a few years later, Tri Khao founded the Kingdom of the Southern Heavens in 1048 and, when that failed, tried again by forming the Kingdom of the Great South in 1052. This time, the Chinese Imperial Army chased him into the Tai area in Yunnan Province, where he died. Although Tri Khao's efforts to carve out a new state like that of the Viet on the edges of the Chinese Empire ultimately failed, this 11th century man demonstrates the extent to which peoples like the Tai and Nung continued to operate in the loosely controlled highlands and had their own state-building projects. And in implementing them, charismatic leaders like Tri Khao obligated Chinese and Vietnamese leaders to intensify their efforts to control, indeed, colonize their highland border areas, even joining forces to do so. More Thai peoples streamed into the Vietnamese highlands in the 19th century as Qing rulers in China struggled to hold their gigantic multi-ethnic empire together. The Qing were themselves Manchus from the northern steppes bordering today's Russia. Nowhere was this more evident than when Chinese authorities finally smashed the Taiping Rebellion that had surged out from its south in the early 1850s and weakened Beijing's control over its part of the highland world rising out of central Indochina. As the Qing armies marched across the southern provinces in the 1860s, their brutal repression sent tens of thousands of mainly Tai and Hmong peoples into the Nguyen Kingdom's northern massif. These refugees joined the Nung and other highland groups such as the Khmu, Lolo, Yao, and Man. In all, more than 30 groups lived in Vietnam's northern highlands, operating under their own chiefdoms and confederations, and sending tribute at irregular intervals to the Chinese, Vietnamese, and others. Confronting Viet Empire. As is so often the case in the imperial chapters of world history, the colonized borrow heavily from their former colonizers. The Viet were no exception to this rule. The Ming occupation may have only lasted two short decades, 1407-28, but it was a period of intense and rapid military, cultural, and political transfers to the Red River that drew upon a millennium of earlier colonial interactions and structures. The Viet cherished their independence, but they knew their former colonizers intimately and admired them for many things. Little wonder Dai Viet leaders actively sought out Chinese models and technologies. Such things could help them prosper and rule. Thanks to the Ming, for example, the Viet obtained some of the most advanced military technology of the time, cannons, gunpowder, and warships. Post-colonial Dai Viet's leaders also embraced the Chinese bureaucratic model for building and expanding a centralized state capable of recruiting, organizing, and deploying manpower and resources. Chinese statecraft served as a powerful weapon for incorporating and administering Dai Viet's own newly conquered territories. By willingly entering a China-centered East Asian civilizational world that placed Confucian-minded states, real or imagined, in a superior cultural position vis-à-vis their uncivilized and barbarian neighbors, Dai Viet leaders now had a powerful ideology to justify a mission civilisatrice outside their current borders. And pushing Dai Viet leaders from below were new population pressures, the product of the Red River Delta's rapid agricultural expansion. In 1470-71, the Lay Dynasty initiated Vietnam's first real war of territorial conquest by launching a massive attack on the Gia. The Vietnamese mobilized their cannons, navy, and 300,000 troops to strike a Cham force of 100,000 men, but who lacked a charismatic leader. Nearby Khmer and Chinese courts stood by idly as the Dai Viet seized Vajaya and turned it into the province of Binh Dinh. The meaning of the province's name was pacified. The Cham polities of Indrapura, Amaravati, and Vajaya were now Dai Viet. While the fall of Vajaya did not trigger the immediate collapse of the other Cham polities located to the south, Pandaranga and Kautara, from the 15th century, Viet leaders had all sorts of reasons to continue their imperial project southward. The Cham and the Nguyen Empire State. However, the Dai Viet state Dali founded in the 15th century did not preside over Vietnam's colonial expansion to the Gulf of Thailand. The rebel Nguyen military lords did. The long civil war that broke out between the Trinh and the Nguyen in the early 17th century forced the latter further into the south with their leader in the person of General Nguyen Hoang, discussed in our first chapter. Under constant threat of invasion from the Trinh in the north and with little land on which to stand in the southern part of the same state, Hoang and his descendants recognized that their survival depended on taking the rest of the coast from the Cham, promoting Viet settlements in these lands, and taking control of Cham trade with the Indian Ocean and the central highlands. The Nguyen used the Sino-Vietnamese administrative model their forefathers had borrowed from the Chinese, and, like them and others, they compromised with it too and devised all sorts of indirect forms of rule to administer far-flung regions and peoples. Pragmatic colonizers are always the most successful. The Nguyen state was thus born of recurrent civil war, sustained colonial expansion, and military rule. No sooner had the Trinh and Nguyen gone to war in 1627 than the latter struck southward against the Cham. In 1653, Kautara fell to the Nguyen, whose territorial domain now extended from the Haiwan Pass to the Fanreng River. Even the last remaining Cham state, Pandaranga, found itself under intense pressure as the Nguyen required its leaders to send tribute to Wei as a sign of its vassalage. This also sent a clear message to the Trinh in Hanoi that the Nguyen were heading up a separate state with an imperial project at its state-making core. As the Nguyen colonial state expanded southward, its leaders focused on the Khmer Empire too. Starting in the late 17th century, Wei's leaders adopted an increasingly aggressive line toward the Khmer court, now located in Phnom Penh, and intervened directly in Cambodian court politics. This was designed mostly to promote Nguyen control over the lower Mekong and to prevent another rapidly emerging state to the west, that of the Thai in the Chao Phraya River Valley, from moving into the declining Khmer Empire at the Nguyen's expense. And as the Thais pushed into Cambodia, the Nguyen rapidly expanded into the Mekong Delta and the last remaining Cham state blocking their march to the Gulf of Thailand. This is how modern Vietnam's S-like form emerged. The Nguyen created it through colonial expansion. In fact, by the late 17th century, thousands of Viet settlers had already moved into Pandaranga and had no intention of leaving. In 1692, with his back against the wall, Pandaranga's King Po Saut decided to attack the Nguyen forces in order to stop the creation of this S-shaped state before it was too late. The Nguyen leader, Nguyen Phuc Chu, welcomed such a move since it provided him with the pretext he needed to conquer the last Cham state and move his army and more settlers into the Mekong. Confident that the Chinese and Khmers would not intervene, the Nguyen overpowered the Cham, abolished the monarchy, and transformed Pandaranga into the province of Tuan Tan. Convinced of their superiority, the Nguyen required the conquered Cham to adopt Vietnamese customs and dress, speak Vietnamese, and adhere to the Sino-Vietnamese bureaucratic and civilizational models. Such harsh measures provoked immediate resistance. Viewed from the Cham point of view, Nguyen colonial expansion meant the end of everything that had been theirs for centuries, a unique coastal confederation with close commercial, cultural, and religious ties to island Southeast Asia, a distinct language with its own writing system, very different ways of dress and conceptions of time and space, as well as unique social organizations, land rights, and fiscal administration. Always pragmatic, the Nguyen switched rapidly to indirect rule. They had neither the military forces necessary to ensure such a harsh occupation, nor sufficient administrative organizations and civil servants to control these new territories. The new emperor of the Nguyen, Minh Vuong, transformed Tuan Tan, Champa, into a protectorate and promoted association rather than assimilation as his colonial policy. Instead of putting ethnic Viet administrators in charge of what was still a majority Cham population, he sought out reliable yet loyal indigenous intermediaries. These go-betweens could work with the Nguyen to win over the support of the Cham people, administer them more effectively, and thereby legitimate Viet colonial rule more effectively. The Nguyen found an invaluable ally in the person of Po Sakterai Daputa, a member of the Cham royal family. Po Sakterai Daputa saw in collaboration with the Nguyen the chance to protect his people, preserve Cham ways, and assert his power over rivals. Minh Vuong made him king of Pandaranga. While this last of the Cham kingdoms was not an independent sovereign state, as a Viet protectorate, the Cham did recover considerable local powers. In 1712, for example, the Nguyen allowed Cham courts to judge local affairs and set up a court consisting of both Cham and Viet personnel to deal with affairs involving the Viet settlers. The Cham regained the right to speak their language and practice their religions. They also paid lower taxes. Like the Qing rulers who built Tibetan Buddhist temples in Beijing as they pushed China's imperial borders deep into Central Asia, Tibet became a protectorate in 1751, Minh Vuong openly associated himself with the Cham king and helped to renovate the sacred Cham Temple of Tien Phu in Hue, while his Nguyen imperial state expanded deeper into Southeast Asia. None of this, however, changed the fact that having taken Pandaranga, the Nguyen were strategically placed to expand their colonial control into the Mekong Delta, which they progressively did over the next century. By the early 19th century, over 100,000 Khmers joined another 100,000 Cham as subjects of the Nguyen Imperial Order. Severed from the Angkorian Empire, now based in Phnom Penh, Cambodians used the term Khmer Kham to refer to themselves, meaning the Khmers living in the lower Mekong River Valley. Most were wet rice growers, cattle farmers, and Theravada Buddhists. Many Cham also fled into Khmer Kham areas, Phnom Penh, and island Southeast Asia. Some joined the Malays and, on one occasion in the 17th century, successfully convinced a Cambodian king to convert to Islam. But changes in the balance of power always change the dynamics of collaborative relationships, as we have repeatedly heard in this book. Nowhere was this more evident here than when the Thay Son Rebellion set off another round of Vietnamese civil wars in the late 18th century. At the outset, many Cham eagerly joined the Thay Son brothers. In fact, Thay Son, meaning Western Mountains, was the village where the revolt started. Significantly, it was located in the central highlands and ethnically mixed. One Nguyen rebel had a Banar as his second wife. Some have suggested that the Thay Son brothers were the offspring of mixed marriages. It is quite possible. Upon launching their revolt, the oldest of the three, Nguyen Nak, proclaimed himself ruler in the ruins of Ajaya and claimed to possess a sacred sword like one of those of the Highlanders. In any case, the Thay Son uprising was a product of these long-standing interactions between the Viet and non-Viet peoples and between the lowlands and uplands of Vietnam. As military operations rolled through the Cham heartlands and then spread to all of Vietnam, the balance of power shifted back and forth over three decades. Cham elites and peasants adjusted their loyalties and alliances accordingly in the hope that such strategies would keep them out of harm's way in the post-war period. Viet belligerents adapted too. Holed up in the south, the new charismatic leader of the Nguyen, Gia Long, carefully stitched together a series of alliances with the Khmer Kham, the local Chinese, various religious groups, and the Cham. In exchange for their collaboration, he promised them all indirect rule, autonomy, and respect for their customs, religions, languages, and local identities. To the Cham, he swore the restoration of the Pandaranga monarchy under future protectorate rule. And in 1802, after having victoriously unified all of Vietnam under Nguyen rule, Gia Long made good on his word. He re-established the Pandaranga throne and carefully avoided policies that could turn the non-Viet peoples against him. Imperfect as it was, peace largely reigned until the emperor's death in 1820. Minh Mang and the Rise of Cham Anti-Colonialism. The same could not be said of his son, Minh Mang, 1820-41, who intentionally reversed his father's commitment to indirect imperial rule. Much more Confucian-minded than Gia Long, Minh Mang was obsessed with order and determined to deploy the Sino-Vietnamese bureaucratic model to achieve it. This entailed establishing the unflinching loyalty of his subjects, including the hundreds of thousands of non-Viet ones. If that meant assimilating all of his subjects to his Sino-Vietnamese administrative model, political identity, and common culture under his personal control, then so be it. Although one could argue that what Minh Mang was doing was remarkably modern in terms of rationalizing the state, centralizing power, and homogenizing identity, his harsh application of such policies created a sea of resistance and a wall of non-Viet hate. In 1832, if not earlier, Minh Mang ordered the dismantling of the protectorate over Pandaranga, the abolition of the Cham monarchy and its indigenous administration, and their incorporation into the province of Binh Tuan under a Viet governor named by him. Gone, too, were the Cham courts and mixed personnel tribunals. the Vietnamese Imperial Army arrived to ensure order and enforce new labor, tax, and land laws. As we saw in Chapter 2, the Emperor of the Nguyen also applied the same policies to the Khmer Krom while simultaneously trying to colonize all of Cambodia. The Emperor required the Cham and Cambodians to dress like the Vietnamese, eat like the Vietnamese, and learn Vietnamese. Minh Nang actively discouraged and often prohibited the practice of Islam, Theravada Buddhism, and Hinduism, judged inferior to Sino-Vietnamese civilization and the Confucian model upon which it turned, in his view. For the Cham and Cambodians, colonial assimilation not only shattered their political independence for good, but it also threatened their very existence as separate cultural and religious identities. The Cham have left records of the hardship they endured under Vietnamese colonial exploitation. As one voice cried out in the 1830s, the Cham lords were forced to abandon the celebration of their rites for their ancestors. The lords were made to say that the Cham traditions were bad and had to be abandoned, and that the Vietnamese traditions were appropriate and had to be followed. Desolation was real. There is nothing left in front or behind of us. All the things that we used to produce with hard work have been taken away. Nothing is left for our subsistence. The Nguyen forcibly recruited Cham and Khmer labor to build roads, bridges, and canals, just as they did in Cambodia during the construction of the Vinh Thai Canal. Colonial corvée was not a French creation, nor were the French the first to face anti-colonial resistance movements. It was in these dire circumstances that a Muslim Cham named Khatip Sumat arrived in Pandaranga from Cambodia. He had just returned from Mecca and was determined to help organize a resistance movement against the Vietnamese and spread Islam at the same time. To this end, he organized guerrilla forces among the Cham and nearby highlanders and declared jihad, holy war, on the Nguyen infidels. Furious, Minh Nang rushed in his troops, armed local Viet settlers, and called upon both to crush the rebels and this foreign faith. Popular support for Khatip declined as the army cracked down violently and several Cham elites realized that this man might not have had their interests foremost in his mind. Another Muslim leader, this time a local Cham named Gia Thach, took over and forged alliances with remaining royal family members, a range of highland peoples, and other Viet at odds with Wei, and there were many. But Minh Mang persevered, and in early 1835 his army smashed Gia Thach and the rest of the Cham rebels. The result was catastrophic for the Cham, who now became, along with the Khmer Krom, second-class citizens in their own lands. And Thai, not French, intervention in Cambodia at this time may have been the only thing that saved what remained of the Khmer Empire from becoming a permanent part of the Vietnamese one. Highland Vietnam, the limits of colonial assimilation? While Vietnamese colonial expansion had always focused on the lowlands, the Nguyen were as engaged as their predecessors in Hanoi had been with the surrounding highlands, and vice versa. Although the court found it difficult to recruit people willing to work in the highlands, considered by many Viet to be inhospitable and insalubrious places, the Nguyen regularly sent administrators, merchants, and armies into the highlands to explore and survey the area, and also to repress and tax non-Viet populations whenever possible. In 1697, for example, the Nguyen created the barbarian tax, Thuy Man. Less than a century later, such taxation generated real hardship, enough to stir highland peoples to revolt under the Thay San. The Nguyen intensified their relationships with the central and northern highlands when they unified all of the country at the turn of the 19th century. Often working through Chinese merchants, Nguyen monarchs traded in cinnamon with the Jirai headmen. So lucrative was this commerce that Minh Mang made its production a crown monopoly. Also reinforcing Nguyen interest in the highlands was the expansion of the Thais into Lao territories to the west. In the north, as we heard before, the Qing repression of the Taiping and Highlander rebels in southern China had sent tens of thousands of Thai and Hmong peoples flowing into northern Vietnam. Joining them were local militias and bandit groups, of which the Black Flags, paramilitary forces crossing the Sino-Vietnamese border, were important examples. Worried by all of this activity in the borderlands, the Nguyen began collecting information on the upland peoples, their languages, customs, and social organization, at the same time as exploring ways of better administering them. In the northern highlands, the Nguyen improved salaries and offered fast-track promotions to Viet administrators who accepted tough posts in these remote parts of the empire. In the north, the Wei court adapted the Chinese Tusi system, Tô Ti, in Vietnamese, in order to rule rugged Thai areas through local hereditary chiefs. For example, Wei authorized the local strongman, Deo Van Tri, to collect taxes, trade in opium, and administer justice locally on the condition that he ensure security in the northwest, forward tax revenues to the court, and maintain his people under Nguyen sovereignty. With roots in the 11th century, this classic form of indirect rule allowed loyal hereditary chiefs to rule vast territories alongside ethnic Viet imperial administrators. Even the assimilationist-obsessed Minh Mang had to concede in the 1830s that direct rule was impossible in this part of his empire. This was also true for the central highlands looking down over Wei, where the Nguyen reinvigorated their tributary relationships as another form of indirect rule. In 1831, Minh Mang applauded the arrival of Gerai emissaries to his court, especially when they solemnly presented him with tribute symbolizing their submission to Nguyen imperial rule. Today, Minh Mang gushed on one august occasion in the 1830s, enthroned in the royal palace so as to receive tribute from these envoys, I saw with my own eyes that they were properly guarded, and they bowed in the prescribed ceremonial manner. Nguyen officials sent their emissaries to the Gerai and Radi lands to participate in the oath ceremony, during which the Nguyen annals tells us both sides mixed alcohol with clear water, poured it in a vase, and used bamboo tubes to draw it up and drink it. Performed before hundreds of highland elites, this public ceremony demonstrated lowland Nguyen respect for the highland peoples, while simultaneously confirming Gerai's submission to Nguyen imperial sovereignty. The French would reenact this ceremony for the same reasons, but they did not create it, for they were not the first colonizers in this part of the world. The Highlanders and the Nguyen also built walls to deal with each other, but not just in oppositional terms. In 1819, the Nguyen dynasty erected a 127-kilometer-long wall in Quang Nai province, to protect them from upland attacks coming from the Ri, while the Ri sought to stop Vietnamese from moving into their territories. However, recent research also shows that the Vietnamese and Ri people built this wall together, and that they did so in part to maintain and provide security for interzonal trade and diplomatic relations. Such exchanges had been occurring for centuries between the upland and lowland areas. The wall was one site for this. Markets were another. While the balance of power increasingly tilted against the Highlanders, the relationships between the two sides were often more complex than we might first imagine. From imperial to national orders in the Highlands, enter the French Empire. Unsurprisingly, the French faced many of the same problems as their Viet predecessors when it came to incorporating Highland territories and peoples into their colonial state, the Indochinese Union. The list is familiar by now. The need to thwart competing powers from moving into the region from the west, the Thais, but also with the British now in the background too. Chronic disorder along the Sino-Vietnamese border as the Qing dynasty melted down. An acute lack of knowledge of Indochina's highlands, and a never-ending shortage of civil servants to rule these vast areas. The crucial difference between the two imperial projects vis-à-vis the highlands is that by toppling the pre-existing Nguyen Empire, the French generated